This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
That is the most wonderful sound. What you're hearing are razorbills, guillemots, kittiwakes, fulmars. There's all sorts of stuff there. There's a cliff face directly in front of me, which is volcanic and it's twisted. So it's metamorphic rock. I mean, basically it's been twisted and tortured into shapes. And in every little nook and cranny and crevice are these seabirds. This is Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. That's just a phenomenal sight.
This is a great way to start the programme. Stunning. At the moment, we're in the south of the Isle of Man.
And what we're going to be doing is catching a boat from here across to the Calf of Man, which is the adjacent island. And if it's half as good as this, it's going to be a cracking trip.
So we're going to head out to the Calf of Man, a small bird sanctuary off the south of the island. It takes about half an hour to get there, 40 minutes to the harbour, and then we're going to drop you ashore and we're going to give you a little bit of time ashore and see plenty of wildlife on the way.
Jason Fleming takes tours out from Port Erin on the Isle of Man.
We flew over it on the way in and it looks gorgeous.
It's a beautiful little island. It's certainly a gem within the Isle of Man's crown, certainly a gem within the whole of the Irish Sea. And now as it's a bird sanctuary, it's quite unique as well. It's very untouched by day-to-day modern life. People that we take out there, they really want to get away from day-to-day life. That's where we take them.
Is it just my imagination, Jason? Is it likely to be a bit bumpy today?
It's going to be slightly bumpy going out. It'll be even worse coming back. We might run you back to Port St Mary, and then we'll be on the sheltered side, and we'll just take it as it comes. But unfortunately, yes, we've got these north winds coming in now, so it's just going to give it a little bit unsettled for us today.
Good stuff, good stuff.
So what kind of wildlife are we likely to see?
The main of the wildlife that we get around here are certainly the seals, the commons and the greys, plenty of the seabirds as well. And occasionally, if we're lucky enough, we do get the basking sharks and the dolphins. We get the commons and the Risso dolphins that come in with us. So we were lucky enough last night, we had a group out and we had two dolphins with us. They weren't that interested in the boat. They were more than happy fishing away. But there's an abundance out here and the scenery is something else as well.
Why is it so good?
It's the Isle of Man. It's the Isle of Man. It's a place that's been home for me. I was born and bred on the island. My great-grandparents were from the island as well. I started this 5 years ago, just wanted to change in life. I wanted a slower pace of life. I'm also on the local lifeboat. I've been a crew member there now for nearly 18 years, and I'm station mechanic. And I just decided I love the sea, I love being out here, and I love meeting people day to day and taking a real variety of people out here.
I tell you, the one thing that does strike you is the clarity of the water. It's sand down there, and it is beautiful, beautifully clear.
Amazing clear waters here. The biggest thing here as well now for us on the island is diving. Diving has really taken off. So we get a lot of the other water sports here as well. The kayaking is very, very big, very popular around the island, certainly around the south of the island. And even so more so with the paddle boards now, that's the new up and coming one. And a lot of the guys now are starting to do these night paddleboard sessions, which is something else because they have the lights underneath that then draw up.
Seriously? They put lights underneath the paddleboard?
They put lights underneath the paddleboard itself, and that rises then any of the octopus or anything like that that are down below, the squids, and it's an amazing sight to see.
I don't think he was joking about the weather.
I don't think he was joking about the weather either. Basically just reversed out from the lee of the harbour wall there, and it's fairly blowing.
Yeah, we've got a kind of force four and a half, nudging five.
Yeah.
Jason, I was talking about this before we actually left the harbour. What is this across here on the headland?
So across on the headland is Bradderhead itself. We've got Milner's Tower up on the top, but just below that then is our mines. These were the West mines. Further around the corner then we got our North mines. Originally they were the copper mines. So this side then, predominantly the precious metal was the silver, and then but the main ore that was taken out was for the lead, and then a bit of tin was there as well.
Now you see it, because I worked in Cornwall for quite a long time. And you'd be right, it's a very typical tin copper mine.
Absolutely, right on the foreshore itself. Coal was taken in by rowing boat for the guys for steaming the pump house. Ore was taken out as well. But they also came in through the old, there's a footpath there down to the old miner's office. That particular patch of water there, we class it as the office. So for us locally, and then it's the Skir, which is the group of rocks that just sit on the outside of it. So Milner Tower is dedicated after a gentleman that moved here from London originally. It was Henry Milner. And when he moved to the island, he started to use some of his wealth to help out the locals. So he built St Catherine's Church and the town hall. He also helped out a few of the local fishermen in over the years. And when he died, they decided they wanted to build a monument in his name. And he was a locksmith. Now, looking at it from the sky, looking down, it's actually in the shape of a keyhole.
Really?
Yeah, and if you then imagine the turret carrying on up into the sky, that's the shank of the key with the head of the key going into the keyhole. And he was a locksmith, but his company was a safe company down in London, known as Milner's Safes.
It's getting a bit bouncy now.
We're changing now. We've got this lovely northwest wind picking up, just livening up a little bit, but once we get around the corner, it'll smooth right out. So we're now coming up to what we class as the end of the Isle of Man here. Now this is where the Calf becomes the island and the Isle of Man becomes the mainland. So what we've just gone past now is what we call the Little Sound, and then we've got the Kittlands, which is the main groups of rock that sit in the centre, and then we're going to run through the main sound race itself, and then the Calf itself will be on the far right hand side of the boat.
Explain the Calf to me. What is it?
So the Calf is originally a small island, sits at the southwest of the island. The Calf itself then is a bird sanctuary now, but in its original day, it was actually a dairy farm. Now, before it was a dairy farm, it was actually a rabbit farm as well. So there was a lord that lived on the Isle of Man. He owned the island and he had tenancy farmers in there. And it's gone through many different cycles, and now finally it's become a bird sanctuary since the 1930s. It was then handed over to the National Trust, but the Manx National Trust wasn't set up at that time, and it then got passed back to the Isle of Man for the sum of a pound later on, just once they got all the paperwork sorted, and we had then our own National Trust, known as the Manx National Trust.
Well, what about the lighthouses? As I came over the Calf and the plane, there seemed to be three lighthouses exactly beside each other, you know, complete with walled gardens.
Yeah, there's three lighthouses itself on the Calf.
Yeah, but they're right together.
They are grouped together, but there's also a fourth out to sea. So it started off 1817, 1818, when they were built, the two upper and the lower ones. They were built by the Northern Lighthouse Board. Robert Stevenson was the designer and engineer for Trinity House. And the idea for those two lighthouses, they marked the point of Chicken Rock, 3/4 of a mile out to sea. The problem was, fine at night, no good in the day, no good in the fog. So you still had many merchant ships that were running aground, and eventually, 1875, they built Chicken Rock Lighthouse, which hopefully, once we get round the corner, we'll get a good view of it.
Presumably, this is pretty good for fish here. There seems to be loads and loads of cormorants.
It's very good for fishing. A bit further out to sea where we are now, about 2.5 miles out, we've got a big bank known as Wart's Bank, great for the sand eels. So that's the start of the food chain. So we get a lot of then the smaller guillemots and so forth up, and then the cormorants, and we do really well for the gannets. So a lot of the gannets seem to be up north of the island at the moment, not quite sure why, so they've obviously followed the fish. And this is what we are finding, that things are moving around a lot, but what we're finding every day that we're out here from every year, things are a lot later and later and later, and it seems to be a sign of the times of changing climate.
Explain something to me. For us, we were coming south of the border. Having been here just for a matter of hours, I've come to the conclusion we haven't come to England at all. We've come to the Isle of Man, which is a different thing.
The Isle of Man is a totally different place. People from everywhere come and join us from the Isle of Man, from all over England, Scotland, Wales, and even across the water as well. I've got a few friends that are from Australia, a lot have come from South Africa. There's a real mix of different people here. The locals are actually a minority these days, but we're all very welcoming as well, you know, and it's a good place to live. I still leave my car unlocked. I leave my van unlocked on the harbour there with my work tools in it. We're at a slower pace of life. Trade allure is the main saying here on the Isle of Man. Why do today what you can do tomorrow?
The drinking dragon. Can you see the drinking dragon? Head drinking that way. Neck.
Oh, it's the whole thing.
It's the whole thing.
Sorry, I was looking for a wee rock. That's beautiful, isn't it?
That's absolutely
stunning.
Perfect. You can see the wings. The wings are kind of mantled round as if it were a bird of prey. There's the head. It's even got the sort of horns coming back off the dragon's head. That's brilliant,
nice. Did you get a photograph of it?
100% a dragon.
100% a dragon.
And, you know, the best thing about it is it's a dragon from the other side as well.
The reason you're here, Jackie, is actually to talk about basking sharks, which we will talk about in a minute. But that is truly dramatic.
It's amazing. The other day, we were out on the Manx Basking Shark Watch research boat, and we'd been out for about 5 hours, and suddenly, as we came round the corner through the sound, I saw a shark, and the first one of the season. Got my camera out, got all the DNA testing kit and everything out, and I thought, this is going to be fabulous. First shark of the season, we're going to get a tag on. And it gave me the most wonderful photograph against the drinking dragon. So basking shark, drinking dragon, and then the lighthouse over there known as the Chicken Rock. And then it went down and we never saw it again.
We just switched the engine off now. See what we can hear.
That's interesting. There's a couple of shags right up at the back there, and that's that go noise that you can actually hear.
You listen to Gillingwell, you get that.
There's a chuff calling up there.
Is it a chuff?
Chuff calling,
is that what it is?
Yeah, hear him calling.
Yeah.
We've also got Des Disc. Introduce yourself. What is it you do here?
I used to be a warden on the calf of man. I'd done 2 years on the calf, 2000, 2001. You're on there for 9 months of the year, full-time, like.
You were looking up that, basically it was a scoop out of the cliff face.
Yeah.
Talk me through all the species that were in there. What were you seeing?
Guillemots, razorbills, you could hear the chuff calling there. Fulmers, we're coming along here now to the biggest shag colony on the island, and you will pick up when you look on the cliffs when we were going down and we would be ringing the shags. Basically, the nests are in cracks in the rock. It's like pothole when you go in to actually ring them. And you'll notice all manner of numbers painted on the rocks because it's so easy just to go down, see the numbers on the rocks, go straight to the nest. If you don't, you're just struggling all the time to try and find the actual nests.
What was it like being a warden out here? I can see peak season just now, lots of visitors, but it must go a bit quiet.
It was heaven. It was absolute heaven. I'd spent 11 and a half years working in a factory, making ejector seats for fighter planes, and I hated every minute of it. I just got to the stage where I thought, I've just got to break this up, this monotony of just coming in from work and sort of like making you a meal, making the fire, bringing the dog for a walk, sitting down and watching television. And I just wanted to do this. I'd come over as a child with my parents. We come out one Sunday. We always used to go out for a Sunday drive. We spent a Sunday on here, and it was just my dream island. And I always wanted to work on here. And I eventually got the job in the year 2000. Yeah, it was just 2 years of absolute heaven. Nobody looking over your shoulder, no timetables. Plus, there's no pub or anything on the island or any shop. It's just, you know, the currency on the calf of man is alcohol and chocolate. Where can you spend your money on the island, like, you know? This place here had the biggest colony of the Manx shearwater. Uh-huh. This had the biggest colony in the world, and they lived here. And the Manx people are superstitious, and there's certain words that you're not allowed to say. And I'm not going to say it, you know, because we're fishermen. Fishermen don't like using it. And the word is the big mouse, and I don't want you to say the big mouse. So a boat come here, ran aground, and all these left the actual boat, and they got in here. And because the shearwaters are like the puffins, they nest in burrows. Mm. They're easy prey for them all. And they just absolutely decimated the population.
Exactly the same thing happened on the island of Rum in Scotland. Mm. And
don't say it.
I'm not. And there was a concerted campaign. I can't remember how much money they spent. It was a lot of money, basically, to try and get rid of these rats, which was fine, but...
Sorry? Go on, then.
Oh, bugger!
Bite iron.
That's it. Free tail.
Long tail.
Right, fine. But the rabbit population exploded.
Yeah,
absolutely exploded on the island.
Yeah. We have a big population here between 5,000 and 6,000.
Before we go any further, if you look careful up there, you'll see our
sheep
or Loctons. Can you see them up there? Now, this is a rare breed, and they think the Vikings brought these over because they're very, very similar to the soy which you get on Kilda, St. Kilda. And the actual word Lockton, it's two Gaelic words. It means mouse brown,
okay.
the actual translation. So you can see them right up there on the cliffs, can't you? You know, I'd be on there and I'd be walking somewhere and there would be a mother with two lambs and I'd think, what's she bringing them onto the cliffs for, you know? Yeah. But the hardy things, grasses. They really are hardy. The people reckon that they're, you know, half goat, half sheep. Big population on there. We got about 70 Loctons on there. And when I was on in 2001, we had that big scare about foot and mouth. Mm-hmm. And they quarantined the island, which was even worse for us because it was just me and the ornithologist. Nobody was allowed on the island. And for 9 months, it was just the two of us. And the reason being that they quarantined it, if it had gotten on the mainland, and I say the mainland meaning the Isle of Man, and all the Loctons and all the cattle had to be destroyed, at least we had a base here of 70 Loctons that we could continue the breeding program.
Jackie, we spoke to you on the way across on the boat, but we didn't introduce you properly. So introduce yourself.
My name's Jackie Hall. I'm a marine biologist, and I run Manx Basking Shark Watch. We set it up in 2004 to study basking sharks, and we've been doing that ever since.
We're in the harbour behind the Calf of Man, just the wee jetty. The water behind us is gin clear, slightly tinged with green. Seaweed-covered rocks around about us. You can hear the oyster catchers in the background. Grass slopes, thrift, green, that sea pink that's actually... It's just glorious, absolutely beautiful place.
It is probably one of the most beautiful places in the world. But don't tell anybody.
Tell me about a basking shark. What is it?
Well, 8 metres long. So if you think about 8 metres for a mature animal, a bit shorter than a big London bus, I always think it's easy for people to relate to. Luckily for us, it only eats plankton. It prefers the shrimp kind of plankton, zooplankton. And it opens that metre-wide mouth and just scoops up the water, sieves out the plankton through its gill rakers, and that's what it lives on, this giant animal.
So effectively, even if you were in the water with it, you're not at risk. It's not interested in you, basically.
You sound like to the sharks that's coming at you.
Well, it's scared a few people over the years, because when they've got their mouths closed, they look very like great whites or tiger sharks. But yes, they are harmless, so long as you don't annoy them or startle them. We get the public involved by using them as volunteers on our boat, and also they can report basking sharks that they've seen to us. So there's a huge public interest in the sharks. So we try to encourage people to watch from professional wildlife watching boats like this or from the shore. Most of our basking sharks here are seen from the shore.
How much is known about the life cycle of the basking shark? Because, I mean, they come and they go.
Well, they're very difficult to study.
Well, these people thought...
She said plaintively.
People thought they used to hibernate.
They did used to think they hibernated. Now, because of the satellite tagging work that various scientists, including ourselves, have been doing, we know that that's not true. They keep going all year round and they're feeding, as far as we can work out, all year round. But to answer your question about the life cycle, they have live babies, maybe 4 or 5 or 6 of them at a time. There's only been one record of somebody seeing a basking shark give birth. They're very secretive about it. The basking shark babies are about as tall as you or I, 1.5 metres, that kind of length. And they look quite different to the adults. They're very slender, they're very zippy in the water, and they've got weird little piggy-like noses. By the time they're 5 metres long, they start to bulk up a bit and get a bit fatter.
We were talking about, you know, how they grow, how they mature, etc. Where do they go at certain times of the year?
Ah, well, we've been satellite tagging them now since 2007. I think we've put 35 satellite tags on so far, Manx Basking Shark Watch and a French group that we work with, Apex. And what we have found, and other scientists that we work with, Dr. Matt Witt, from Exeter University has been tagging up in northwest Scotland. And what we've found is a very mixed pattern. They are inshore in the summer, at the surface in summer, feeding, because that's where the plankton is in the summer. In the winter, we've got three different patterns of behaviour that we're seeing. One is that they stay quite local to the Irish Sea. We've got another population that in the winter is going long distance travelling off Spain, off the continental shelf, and we've had several that have gone down as far as Moroccan waters. Now that was very exciting to us. We had one shark in 2007 went across to Nova Scotia. So we've got that pattern. And then we have ones that have gone up to Norway and up further north. So to be honest, people are going to have to keep satellite tagging until we find that pattern. We're also trying to find out if there's different genetic groups. So you know how you take a genetic sample easily from a human by just scooping some skin cells off the inside of the cheek? We can get basking shark DNA, luckily, from that horrid black slime that's all over them. So we get ourselves a very, very long pole and just go, whoosh, make it sound easy, don't I? It's not easy. And we send that to Aberdeen University. And we're trying to find out if there are different groups exhibiting those different kinds of behaviours.
So there's still a lot of work to be done. There's still a mysterious big shark.
They are mysterious and they are very, very big.
We're now on the Calf of Man, having come off the boat, and we're just walking through carpets, a sea pink, and the rocks themselves are covered in this sort of, almost a sort of hairy green lichen.
So it's obviously like a damp kind of place.
Damp kind of place, but I mean, it's really
usually
lovely.
It's a good quality off the air too, if you've got this lichen, it's an indicator of it.
Seems like a long way from an ejector seat factory.
You understand why I come out here then, yeah? It's just absolute heaven. I could come down here on a summer's evening and there'll be about four yachts in the bay here. This is called the Puddle, by the way, this sort of area here. And I thought, where are they from? And they come all the way from Wales. And there was something in a yachting magazine that said there's a paradise on earth, just, you know, 40 miles across the Irish Sea.
It's wonderfully peaceful.
Yeah.
Come on up and we'll walk up a bit further here, chaps. We'll have a sit in this seat.
You could just sit here for
sit here and daydream, and I'm thinking maybe we should just do that for a while.
He's popped up handy now, that seal, isn't he? You can see the sun glinting off his head. We haven't got any round here, but I'd have liked to have made you a bumby cage.
What's a bumby cage?
A bumby cage is a thing that was made for the children, and a bumblebee was put inside it. Bumblebee to the Manx in the old days was a bad fairy.
So they were punishing the bad fairy.
Yeah. It was put in it in this cage to teach it a lesson. What would happen is the children would go to bed and the parents would tell them to pray for the spirit of the bad fairy, the bumblebee, in this cage. And by the power of prayer, they could give the bumblebee its magic back. What would happen is the children would go to sleep. Parents would come in the middle of the night, undo the top of the bumby cage and let the bumblebee out. But because we, bumblebees, they're getting a bit scarce in the ground. Now, what we do is we put in a seashell, which is a periwinkle. The Manx Gaelic word for it is a fagog. And as kids, Port Mary Beach, we used to pick these shells up.
So you stuck it in your knuckle?
Yeah. Basically in between your fingers, almost as if you're making a fist and it's stuck in there.
That's it,
right.
Like a fist. And when you look through the V, through the V in your fingers, you do this.
That's probably, I'm going to try that. Right, let me see.
Maybe some considerable time.
Maybe weeks.
So which way do you point it?
Like that?
No. How is it done?
I watched him. Why is that not like it? Right.
Because you didn't take it in. You rushed into it.
Right, what we do is hold them like that so that the hole's at the top of your forefinger.
Wait a minute. I'll come around this side.
See? Left hand.
Left hand. Okay, like
that's
that.
It. And then what you do is you push it right up into the groove between your finger and forefinger and middle finger.
Okay, like that.
Try and have them square to your knuckles, nice and square. Just blow down the V with your fingers. You almost got it. Oh, so close.
It's like a death rattle.
Sometimes, a little trick is to angle your hand. There you go.
Hey! I'm blowing harder. There's nothing happening. I feel faint now.
Yeah. Will you lie down amongst the pinks?
I think I might.
We'll just head over to this bit of headland here, boys.
What attracted us to this bit was your opening sentence, and I must confess it wasn't one I expected. Come on, I'll show you the plastic puffins. Explain.
Well,
as if you don't want the tourists to be disappointed.
Yeah, that's right. Puffins. That's very, very true. You've got to remember, when the people are coming on the boat, you know, everybody seems to love puffins, and they say, will we see puffins?
Yes.
I say, guarantee we'll see puffins. But when we get out here, the puffins that they actually see are these plastic ones. I think what we're coming to here here we go. Here's the sound system.
It's not just one puffin, it's 3-6 puffins. They're very realistic.
Yeah. It is working. It is working, because you will see them out here on the water. You know, I have seen a lot more than what you normally do. I always say to the people on the boat, if they spot a puffin, to go home and put a pound on the lottery. That's how lucky they are to actually see them.
These are superb. I mean, they are, I must say, I was going to say life-size. They seem slightly bigger to me than...
Almost rucksack-sized.
Steady now. I didn't hear that.
You just...
Do you know...
What's that over there?
That's what got me about this, you know, sort of, how many people are coming off here and thinking, I'll have one of them, you know, look good in the garden.
Yeah.
But here's how it's all done. It's with a solar panel here to charge the batteries. Last year when I was helping out, the batteries were getting low in it, and they didn't sound anything like a puffin. It was a strange gargled sound, you know what I mean? You got it.
It's like a puffin with a really bad hangover.
That's it. You've got it.
Right. Well, we're heading back to the boat, but thank you very much. It's been brilliant.
Sorry, it's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I need to get a photograph of the plastic puffins, so we'll be back in a moment.
Yeah, we would count them before he gets back in the boat.
On the flock, Chris. On the bow now.
So what are you
doing?
So
here we go, we're just seen two of our puffins. So as we said earlier, as Desi called them, the big mice, drove them off the calf. Slowly now that we're getting a few of them back again. We had 5 last year. This year we've had 3. That we've been sighting, and these are the same two as last night. So we're on Spanish Head now, the corner of Spanish Head, between the calf and what is then Port St Mary. So we just have our puffins here now. Hopefully they're just coming in on the port side. There's the two of them. So they're in with a couple of razorbills and a couple of the guillemots.
Yep.
And there's our little puffins. So hopefully things are going to be on the up once we start breeding and nesting again on the island. It's just trying to get them and reintroduce them back to the calf itself.
You called this Spanish Headland, why?
The myth for here is that one of these Spanish galleons on the Armada sank just off the coastline here. So this is where then it's always been then classed as Spanish Head. But the island itself around the Calf and around the south of the island, it's absolutely littered with shipwrecks. We get a lot of divers that come over here to dive some of these shipwrecks. And one of the most predominant ones that we've got within the sound itself landed on the rocks known as the Colettes, and that was the Brig Lily disaster. Uh-huh. Out of the 14 crew and the family that were on there, the captain's family, they were washed away. There was only 9 survived. Then what happened, the problem was then a few days later, the locals were tasked with the surviving crew to go out and salvage the cargo. The problem was the cargo was gunpowder and it blew up on them. And 29 out of the 30 that went to the ship to salvage the cargo died, and only one survived.
When was this?
So this was in 1852, December 27th. Now, it's also come to light a few years ago that there was a gentleman that had actually gone aboard before the salvagers had gone out there. And there's a letter now that I need to try and do a bit more research on. Mm-hmm. And this family have now found this letter. Basically, it was him owning up to actually being on the wreck before the salvagers got out there. And he had a candle that he left on the boat. Right. And they're saying that was then the cause of it to actually to blow up. And the blast itself was actually heard in Douglas, so that's over 12 miles away. So there was something like 54 children were orphaned and around 12 widows at that time. And then on the other side of Thuzla, then we had the Clan McMaster, so she was 1923. One of the clan boats, she was full of Singer sewing machines. Now, the locals saved all the crew, and then the following evening, under the cover of darkness, got out and pilfered the cargo. So they've always said that the story is, when we tell people about it and we show the pictures of the wreck, the story is that everybody in the south of the Isle of Man has a Singer sewing machine. It's steeped in history around here, and as I say, plenty of shipwrecks around the island. It makes for amazing diving. And as you said earlier, the waters are so clear, that's why they come here and they love it.
I'll come back into port. As you can hear, it's kind of choppy out there at the moment. Jason, I really enjoyed that. And Des, it was great to be on the island.
It's been a pleasure having you on the show today. And it's at least the weather's held off enough so we can get you back safely. That's been the main one.
Yeah, I thought basking sharks were kind of guaranteed, Jackie.
Sorry. I can only apologise.
Just so much information and a great wee island to get out to.
You've been to the Isle of Man before, I haven't. But what's astonishing me, even on a very short acquaintance, is how many echoes there are here between what you would expect to find on the west coast of the Northern Isles of Scotland and here. Even the way they build sometimes, that wee, not so much the cottage directly in front of us, but the wee outhouse beside it, the way they've stepped the sort of, it's not even slate, it's like big thick slabs of stone. That's more like Caithness or Orkney or something of the kind. I mean,
we're looking at a wee field. You could be on the island of Col quite easily or Canna. It's a delightful place, and it's just fascinating. And as you said, so many echoes of Scotland. We've got real close connections with this place.
It's got a lot of history here, obviously, and we're heading down a track at the moment towards part of that history. It's called Craignish. And what's wonderful about it is it's not a construct. It's not something that's been put together like Disneyland. This is part of living history that's been brought back into sort of full life, full exposure. And we're just going down to talk to a lady called Helen Ashcroft.
This is Carron's farmstead, which is in the middle of the village of Craignish and used to be occupied by the Carron family. It was formerly a home and a small farmstead, like a crofting farm, quarterland farming. It's an early example of quarterland farming. And
what's quarterland farming, sorry?
It's in a treen. You'd have a would be split up, a treen or a parish would be split up into four quarterland farms. There might be five. There might be, you know, a bit of variant, but on the whole, there was four farms for that treen or parish.
This would be the farmhouse, thatched farmhouse.
Yes, it was originally the farmhouse, and then latterly it was a cowshed.
That is a really clever piece of design. They've got stones sticking out of the wall that you can effectively lash the roof onto. In the Western Isles, they would put ropes down, but the stone would just be hanging there. It wouldn't be attached to the wall. That's much cleverer.
We get some pretty strong winds around here, and you feel the full benefit of it at Craignish. And so we call them bugs again, which is the Manx word for them. And they were to really tighten that roof down because, you know, the wind can get pretty high. There's a bit of folklore surrounding them as well, so you'll notice that they're never painted, whereas the rest of the house has been whitewashed. They are never, because it's meant to be bad luck. Of course, if you whitewashed the bugs again, it would also erode the rope a lot quicker. So actually, a lot of these superstitions are based on pretty practical reasons.
It is a delightful wee village, though, isn't it?
Yes, it's beautiful.
So are all the cottages and the steadings genuine? Because one of the criticisms that could be levelled at some heritage villages is they take a few and then they build some more.
Well, I think that's our unique selling point, I suppose, for Craignish, is that this is actually a real village with real dwellings, and we've not brought anything in and recreated anything. We've got genuine ancestors that lived in these homes and, you know, families that remember their granddads and grandmas being here, and yeah.
That's lovely. Come on, have a look in Harry's house.
Harry Kelly was the last resident in what's now known as Harry Kelly's cottage, and in 1935 he passed away, and recognising that he lived in a house that represented a lifestyle that was becoming obscure, you know, lifestyles were changing, people were living in bigger houses, and his house was very old-fashioned for its time. His family very generously gave the house over to the Manx Museum and National Trust to work with this idea of an open-air museum. It was the first one that opened in the British Isles, and it opened in 1938.
They kept the cottage pretty much as it was when Harry lived there, but they made a few changes to strip it back a little to a slightly earlier era. Mm-hmm. So he had a concrete floor, which they stripped out in the main room, and he also had a range, which was a modification that they thought they could pull back to the old open fireplace, which was much more traditional.
Why is there a bit of wool in the doorway?
It's a bit smoky in here. It's quite a low doorway, and that immediately draws your attention to it, so you're less likely to bang your head as you come in.
Okay, I thought it was maybe a superstition or something.
But it is delightful.
We have some
it?
Things that are superstition here. Yeah. So we've got this cross here. It's called a cross cairn. We put them out on night before May Day.
Two sticks held together by wool.
Yeah, that's it. But the sticks can't be cut off the trees, and it's the rowan tree or the mountain ash that they're made from. And wool has to not be shorn off the sheep either. It has to be gathered out of the hedges and things, because that would ruin the magical powers of them. And you put them on your doorways and also on the tail of the cow to ward away evil spirits at the beginning of May.
In Scotland, we plant rowan trees outside a house to keep witches away.
Oh, right, OK. Yeah. So there's a lot of superstition around rowan trees.
A lot of similar stuff.
This is brilliant. Where do you start?
Well, there's a picture of Harry. They're right there on the mantelpiece. He's obviously hand-feeding a sheep. And as I said, this is very similar to how he had it, but the range has been taken out and there's an open fireplace.
Bannock's beacon away now?
Bonnock, we call it, from the Isle of Man. But yes, same thing. It's your daily bread. Yeah. Bonnock, yeah. And you can see how this floor was stripped. Uh-huh. And we've got an earth floor that was revealed underneath. And this floor is very, very robust, and it's still in good condition.
Hammered down.
Right, well, a quick look in the bedroom.
Were you invited?
So this is Harry Kelly's original bed. He got that from the Calf of Man. He managed to wrestle it over here on a boat from the Calf of Man. We were quite a difficult job with one man rowing. He got it up to the cottage, got it up the hill to the cottage, and realised he wasn't going to get it in the door, he wasn't going to be able to get it in his bedroom. So if you look at the bedpost here, it was a full four-poster bed, but you can see actually the marks where Harry's sawn it off at sort of waist height so that he could get it in the room.
But it's lovely to have this.
And his jacket's hanging up at the back of the door and things.
Right,
thank you again. I can't take any more of the smoke.
Yeah, it's really smoky today.
Wow.
And that's how you'll smell for the rest of the week.
It's a peat smoke, the aftershave for men.
Yes.
Fascinating though Craigneish is, you know, historically, it's not just a place with a past, it's a place with a future too. There's a thing called the Craigneish Development Project, and Kate Statham is part of that. Now, before we get into your role, what exactly have you got here? How big is this place?
So I think we're farming on about 230 acres, which is actively farmed, which is mostly grazing, but also some crops as well. But we also have the headlands. So a lot of that is dwarf scrub heath. We've got the maritime slope and cliffs. We've also got lots of semi-improved grassland. So it's full of orchids. So it's really diverse. And because of the small field system, you can see there's lots of hedgerows and things. So the landscape's quite connected. So it's quite unique and quite different to a lot of the farming land across in the UK, because we've kept those small field systems.
We'll have to point out, we are on the flight path for the airport, so it is going to get noisy here.
It's as if you're standing in the 19th century and you've got the 21st century passing overhead.
Yeah. But the small fields are a real feature of that. These are fields that farmers today, in a commercial operation, just wouldn't tolerate.
No, because the hedgerows would obviously get in the way of big machinery, whereas here we've got some fields that are like the long, thin, kind of narrow strips as well. And quite a lot of our pasture hasn't been ploughed, at least since the Second World War, which is something that we're looking to keep as part of our carbon sequestration. So those fields that we've identified that we've called permanent pasture, we're going to keep them as grazing land and keep some of the other fields in rotation for crops.
What have you got running on the fields?
We have got some
London rabbits.
Yes,
you've got some big horses.
Yes, we've got some Shires and some Clydesdales. We've got Lockton's sheep, which is obviously our Manx traditional breed. So a sizeable flock of Lockton's. We also have some Kerry cattle, which are quite new, and they're quite nice and dinky. And I think we still have a small number of beef shorthorn as well.
So is the plan to make this commercial, or is it to just keep the traditional way of farming these fields?
I think it's finding the balance between the requirements of the site, because obviously we are also a visitor attraction and the historical side of it, but it's also got to be profitable for someone. And if we can link that profitability and the kind of financial output of the farm with meeting some of our biodiversity targets as well. That's the ideal, isn't it?
I do like the idea, though, because it's not just to say, you know, it would be very easy to set this in Aspic and say, look, isn't this pretty? Isn't this picturesque and quaint? But, you know, to turn it into a working landscape at the same time and preserve that specialness, mm-hmm. it's worth doing.
Yeah, and it's future-proofing the site as well, because it needs to be able to generate its own income, and part of the heritage is the farming.
So you're going to get them to plough with Clydesdale horses?
That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Just out of curiosity, what was your reaction to the place the first time you saw it?
To be perfectly honest, quite a few times I've driven through before actually stopping, so it's only since I've been working here that I've had a nice walk around, and it's only the last maybe month or so that I've spent more time on the wider farm. And having spent a lot of time on farms elsewhere, I think it's pretty unique in what it has to offer, and the small field system and the diversity of habitats that are in quite a small area. So we've got like acidic grassland, we've got neutral grassland, we've got marsh grassland, lots of different habitats all in quite a compact space. So I think it's really unique, and I think the heritage aspect of it as well is really interesting.
Which of those grasslands are you going to turn into the airstrip?
Maybe this bit of garden here. Yeah, I think that'd be big enough.
This is Moors, which is kind of famous. The only traditional Manx kipakuras on the island, and Peel, which is to the north of the island. It's a great sign, isn't it? Kippers posted from here.
Ring for attention.
Well, we will then. There's a bell hanging here. Hi, Paul, how are you doing?
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Nice
I'm
to
Mark.
You.
Right, this is Ewan.
And I'm Ewan.
How are you? How are you doing?
Oh, great smell.
It's fantastic, ooh, isn't it?
Kippers, a whole place.
Yeah, it's not too good when you go out at night, though.
Do you ever get out of your clothes?
No.
No, not ever.
And why would you want to?
Are you in the process of doing it at the moment?
I'm smoking at the moment, yeah.
Oh, come on, let's have a shift. How long has this place been here?
Since 1882.
Aye.
1882.
Oh, it's an even better smell in here.
Yeah.
This is fantastic.
So what do we have here?
Well, we've got six fires in here. We need quite a lot of heat, so the heat comes from pine. Uh-huh. And the back two-thirds, you put oak and sawdust, which you dampen off, okay. And that gives a smoke. So the flames you see coming out are from the white wood, and the smoke and the flavour comes from the oak and the sawdust.
Yeah. And you're basically using bales of shavings?
It's bales, yeah. We've got to make sure there's no tannalised wood in it. It's got to be pure. Everything we burn is pure. Because
so what have you got in there at the moment?
We've got kippers and fillets in.
Wow. Yeah. Can we see?
I'll show you to them upstairs. I have to go upstairs because they're about 20 feet up in the air.
Oh, right, because we're in a normal-sized room, but they're way up there, are they?
They're way up, yeah. Yeah.
What's the idea of having them that high? It's to do with temperature?
It's to do with temperature, and also the higher it is, the more you can get in.
Okay.
Because we've got seven smokehouses here, aye, and one of them holds about 15 to 20,000 herring.
What?
So you imagine in the heyday in the 1880s, early 1900s, you know, this place was employing between 100 and 200 people.
That's
a lot of herring.
A lot of herring.
So what are these things?
This is the old troughs. The girls go around here and they put the herring on the hooks. Hook. And the expression on tenter hooks comes from it.
Is that it?
That's, yeah.
Tenter
hooks. So they'd put the herring on as quick as they could like that. If you're on tenter hooks, you're on edge, and that's where it comes from.
And then they lift it off?
Lift it off and then they run it into the smokehouses.
Wow, okay. We've learned something.
Yeah. That's one of the old boxes. They used to send them away in the wooden boxes.
That's brilliant.
And they were recycling in those days. It says on it, returnable charge 2 and 6.
So where would they go to? Is it around the world?
They would go mostly to Britain. Mostly to Britain. But I have had emails from people as far as New Zealand, Australia, South Africa.
Yeah.
They've had these boxes.
Do you just do herring, kippers, that kind of thing?
We do smoked salmon. I do a lot of fresh crab meat as well. That's very popular. Obviously, we don't smoke it, but we do fresh crab meat. Herrings and herring fillets. Okay. That's our main business now.
Shellfish at all?
I'll do a bit of queenies maybe now and again. Mm-hmm. But again, in the Isle of Man now, they're all on quotas now, and the quotas have gone down a lot in the last 2 or 3 years, and it's very difficult to get them now.
So do you get king scallops as well?
We get king scallops. We've got fantastic king scallops here, fantastic queenies. They're doing a good job now, the government, because they're regulating it all, which should have been done 10 or 15 years ago. They're too late, really, but they're doing the best they can now.
But they did put this regulation that isn't in place in Scotland. I mean, they do have areas of no-take zones for nursery areas, and it's not rocket science. Leave them somewhere to breed.
don't take them out all the time.
Yeah. Well, inside our 3 mile limit, I think it's something like 70% of the water you can't fish in now. And that's only come in the last 5 years. So they're doing a lot of nursery beds there as well. There's certain times you can fish as well. So they are putting a lot of regulations.
Have you seen any improvement in it? Or?
In fact, the catches have probably gone down at the moment because they can't fish where the bulk of the stuff was. They're not allowed to fish there anymore.
Yeah, but potentially long term.
Oh, long term, yeah. Long term, it'll be fantastic. The boats will probably be able to do short days and catch a good quantity of stuff and make it a good living without using all the diesel. So it's helpful for the environment as well.
Yeah, cool.
Which is good.
Sure, it's a good
one. Yeah.
Where is this?
I'm going to have to give it a bit of a kick here because it sticks.
Oh, wow.
The flies you saw downstairs, these two doors are corresponding. So what I would do is... put your hatches down.
Put your hatches down. Yeah.
Sorry.
You're obviously accustomed to it. I couldn't cope with that.
So I'll just show you what we've got in there.
Did you hold your breath?
Yeah.
He's disappeared into an absolute wall of smoke.
They've only been in about 3 hours, so they're just starting to get to dry up a bit. But can you see on the end of the tail, all the oil? The herring we buy have got at least 16.5% or 17.5% omega oil, which is very good for you. Now, they're just sort of drying up a bit now. After another 2 hours, I'll go and check them. And I can tell by the colour whether they're done or not.
And that lovely golden colour, contrasting with the bright yellow colour that you get in many supermarkets, which is purely dye, isn't it?
We're not allowed to put any dye in them by Manx law. No dye at all.
Quite right, too.
Yeah. It's the salt and the heat that gives a colour. So the more salt you put in them, the quicker they colour, but obviously they can't be too salty.
No, exactly.
So you have to do them right. We did the same thing every time, exactly the same.
I can see them, yep. I'm not coming in again.
No.
So basically, the fish come in, they're gutted, they're split down the middle and opened out almost like a sort of butterfly shape and then hung.
Yeah. The herring now we have to buy from Scotland, believe it or not.
There's
been nothing landed here for 15 years. And in my time in the 70s, when I was 16, I used to come down here every day in the summertime. There'd be 50 boats here. They were doing thousands and thousands of stones of kippers a day.
So why would somebody buy kippers from you rather than Loch Fyne?
Well, good question. That is, good question. Well, when we had fresh local Manx herring, the herring in the Irish Sea are different quality herring. They're smaller and sweeter, and that's why the Manx kipper was always unique, had the best flavour. The North Sea herring are bigger and they're more bony. Loch Fyne kippers are very big, so ours was like sweeter, smaller and sweeter. Now, because I can't get Irish Sea herrings anymore, I have to buy them from Scotland, but I'll buy a medium-sized herring with a very high oil content.
So yours are still better?
Well, hopefully, but...
Well, can we go and try some? We'll soon tell you.
Yeah.
Just checking your fire.
Yeah, just checking the fires. If you lose the heat in there, that can cost me 2 or 3 hours tonight.
Yes.
It's quite surprising. Okay. I can normally do these in about 7 hours. If it was filled up to the very top, you'd be talking 15 hours. In the 70s, when they were doing maybe 4 or 5 smokehouses, they could work from 4 in the afternoon till maybe 12 o'clock lunchtime. They'd do a 20-hour shift.
Wow, 20-hour shift?
20-hour shift, yeah.
That's pretty brutal, isn't it?
Walk this way.
Walk this way.
Blinking into the Isle of Man sunlight.
Glenn, can you just put some kippers on? Yeah, these are little photographs here.
My granny used to do this.
Yeah.
It's my father's side of the family, from Fraserburgh.
Yeah,
so, you know, my granny and my aunts went all the way down the East Coast. I mean, they started off down Great Yarmouth and what have you, worked their way all the way up round, followed the herring fleet essentially.
Yeah. Ours was a long season here. It was from June to September, end of September. Yeah. So lots of girls came from Scotland, Ireland, Shetlands, you know, Southern Ireland a lot. The 70s a lot from the Southern Ireland. The women would do about 5 or 6 a minute, filled them by hand, which is good.
Going off piste completely. We cook bacon every Saturday morning in our programme, and I can't help but seeing you do your own.
Yeah, I forgot to tell you we do bacon.
Traditionally, oak smoke for 168 hours.
It is, yeah. It's actually a week, but it's 168 hours sounds longer, doesn't it?
It does.
It's substantial.
It's a long time. At least a week we put it in.
Yeah.
But not hot fires, just very slow fires.
So you don't lose a lot.
Yeah, so the flavour will permeate into the middle.
Aye.
We sell a lot of that, a lot of bacon.
Well, you're going to sell some more this morning.
In the 1600s, there was over 600 boats fishing here.
Yes,
That's the inner harbour here. All the boats.
you could walk from one side of the harbour to the other on the decks of boats?
Definitely, yeah. That's one of his friends. That was 1958. He came here at 17. And I've known him since then. He did the summer season here. Mm-hmm. End of September, he went to Whitby for 10 weeks fishing for herring. And I said to him, how much did you earn? He said, 110 quid. And that was 1958.
Yeah.
And he's still here. He came back next year, married a Manx girl, and he stayed.
Yeah. You got the kippers? So we take them outside?
We have got the kippers.
I think fresh air might not be a bad idea. I'm still coughing.
You've got that lovely,
deep, oaky brown, but with that much deeper brown on the edges.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's brilliant. Is there a proper way to eat kippers?
Well, I'd use my hands, maybe, but...
I can do that.
I like to eat them with my hands. Nice bit of fresh bread and butter's good as well.
We'll just peel the fillet off. That's hot. That's hot.
Beautiful, delicate flavour.
It's nice, yeah. If you see the oil, and the oils are oozing out of it, and that's what you want, oil.
They're very oily, but they're not overpoweringly salty.
No.
Those ones there, we only leave in for 2 minutes. The fillet's left for 2 minutes. The skipper's left for about 10 minutes. You've got to be very careful, because if somebody's talking to you or something like that, or somebody comes in the shop, you've got to make sure you get your stuff out, because if you leave them in, they're ruined.
The Isle of Man, do you all support each other? By that I mean, do you know, do the hotels and the B&Bs actually say, have kippers this morning for breakfast, and by the way, they come from Moors?
We do get a few, but believe it or not, the tourist trade here was massive in the 70s, and it's gone down a lot.
What?
But the government are now trying to reinvigorate it. And there's lots of investment in new hotels in Isle of Man in the last 3 or 4 years, which is a good sign. Also, the Manx government just bought the Isle of Man steam packet company, so hopefully they'll bring the fares down, get more people over here and market it correctly.
And serve Manx kippers on the boat. Usually we just have a wee nibble of these things.
Well, you're horsing your way through it.
One kipper gone. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You can have more if you want.
Don't tell them that. Dr. Andrew Foxon is an expat Scot who now lives in the Isle of Man and runs a company called Go Man Adventures. Just fill in the scene for us. Where are we and what are we looking at?
Well, we're walking along a shingle beach here at the Point of Ayr, northernmost point of the Isle of Man. And if we look to the north, we can see Scotland, the southern coast, looking towards the southern uplands. I can see the Mullagh Galloway, Burrowhead, the Merrick, and then over to the east is Cumbria, and we can see the top of Scafell Pike and the Lake District there.
And if we went round, presumably the other side of the point here, we'd be able to see Ireland, maybe?
Yeah, if we went just about another half mile, we'd see northern parts of Northern Ireland. Mountains of Mourne are only about 50 miles away from the Isle of Man. So we're more or less in a central position in the North Irish Sea.
But an awful lot of people, Scotland, Ireland, Cumbria, they don't know much about the Isle of Man. It's this strange little wee island in the middle of the Irish Sea, but it's right on everybody's doorstep.
It is. I suppose it's one of those places that you might fly over or sail by, but unless you're coming here, you don't necessarily stop off on the way. But and for a lot of folk, if you went back into the 50s, 60s and 70s even, it was a major holiday resort. If you didn't go down the water or from Northern Ireland up to the northern coast, you came overseas to the Isle of Man for your holidays.
What brought you here?
Holiday initially, yes.
Oh, really?
I'm an archaeologist by background, and I was working as a keeper of archaeology in Hull museums in the northeast of England. And my wife comes from Northern Ireland, and we were looking for somewhere to go on holiday before we went to stay with her folks. And we looked on the map, and the Isle of Man was on the route. And we came here and both fell in love with the place within a couple of days. About 2 years later, a job for a senior manager with the heritage agency here, Manx National Heritage, came up. So I put my application in and moved here 22 years ago.
This is a really strange landscape. We are, you said earlier on, we're on a pebble beach, but there's mile after mile of these beautiful, smooth stones. You get the real sense of the power of the sea here. There's a big, massive, powerful swell.
It's a terraced beach, essentially.
It is. What you've got here, all of the land that we're around here, the Isle of Man has hills, but this northern part was the gift of the glaciers. Glaciers covered the whole of the Isle of Man, maybe as much as a 1,000 metres thick at one point. And they scooped up bits of Scotland and Ireland and the northeast of England. And when those glaciers melted, they left soils and shingle and rocks. And it's eroding on the western coast. And it's then being redeposited on the northeast coast where we are. So it's sorting out the small material and it's dropping off small shingle and pebbles and cobbles.
I love the idea of the various kingdoms of the sea building an island. It's a wonderful image. But describe this to us, because we've got these weird lighthouses and the big foghorns. As I said before, it's a really strange world.
Yeah, so we've got in front of us the Point of Ayr Lighthouse. It was built 1818, and they had it really as a warning to shipping here. Although we've got the sea around us, if you look towards Cumbria, the underneath the sea, it's really very shallow. So the only safe route for ships of any depth is to come really quite close into shore, and that's quite risky. And so they put the light there really as a warning. Then there's a little light as well that we call the Winky. As in Wee Willie Winky, yes. Originally, it was much closer to the original light.
Okay.
But because of all the deposits being built here, the land was gradually extending into the sea. So they moved it to where it is now. And in principle, they should move it another 100 metres, but it's not going to be moved because the land has grown again and stuck into the sea.
We've had to come the sort of long way around about the houses because there's this string tying off parts of the shore. You can see Arctic terns there. This is obviously a nest site. They're lovely, lovely animals.
Aren't they just? Lovely, lovely call, but you don't want to mess with them.
No.
No, and the reason this the fence posts and the strings are here are to protect their nests on the shingle and also golden plovers as well. They nest here too.
Presumably they're still pretty vulnerable to foxes and... I don't know, do you have badgers on the island?
We have no foxes, we have no badgers.
Shows you what I know.
We've got no moles, no snakes.
Is that just because it's geographically... Because, you know, it's so many boats coming in, so much... Flotsam and jetsam, you would have thought it was inevitable that some of these species would be here.
Some of them aren't here because the sea level rose with the glaciation and the island became an island and they never made it here. So we have no moles on the Isle of Man. They have no moles in Ireland either. Foxes.
I didn't know that.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
But you would also thought, you know, Britain as a nation has taken foxes and all kinds of things to every corner of the world to try and make it a bit like England. You would have thought that the same would have happened with people buying estates on the Isle of Man.
We think there may have been foxes here once. There are a couple of Manx Gaelic place names. Cronkshinnach means Fox Hill. And it's difficult to know why you'd name a place like that if you didn't know what a fox was. But in living memory, apart from a couple of cubs that were found by the roadside, which we think somebody had brought into the island, there's no history of foxes here at all.
Where we're standing at the moment is more or less right on the northern tip of the island. There is a fairly strong breeze blowing from the east, you know, coming from England straight at us at the moment. Bracing, I think, is the word I would use. When people come on your trips, what kind of things are they doing?
Really, what we're doing is exploring bits of the countryside. As I say, my own background's archaeology, but I know about the wildlife and the heritage and the folklore and those sorts of things. So what we do is we take a piece of the countryside and explore it for a half day or a day or for longer. One of the trips I did a few weeks ago was a charity fundraiser, and they walked the Radna Faulion, the Way of the Gull, which is a coastal footpath.
That's a lovely name for a path.
Isn't it great?
Yeah.
It runs right round the outside of the island, 100 miles.
See it again?
Radna Faulion.
The
Road of the Gull, or the Way of the Gull.
So is that complete? Can you circumnavigate that?
You can. There are a couple of places where you have to come inland because it's either dangerous or because the route isn't allowed to go through some land. But by and large, I mean, we're actually standing on the route now.
See, it's interesting. 14 miles that way.
Yep.
Scotland.
Aye.
We took the wrong roads to get up to this point, and there's a big sign up saying... private, no entry. But of course, we're not accustomed to it nowadays because we've got right of responsible access. It is different here.
It is, yes. I mean, the law in terms of private property and access is very similar to that in England and Wales rather than in Scotland. We do have what in England and Wales they'd call access land. So we either are going on public rights of way through private land, or there are areas where you can walk freely. We call those as having the right of public ramblage.
You think England and the Isle of Man's ever going to catch up with us?
I don't think so, no. There's a completely different approach to land ownership and rights. I mean, as you say, I grew up in Scotland. I've worked in England. I've lived and worked in the Isle of Man for the last 22 years. I've been involved in some policy discussions and development. And although I've nudged it to say Scotland is a good example in terms of access and route and crossing land and wild camping as well, though it has its complications in places, I've never seen any appetite on the island to extend. That's not to say there aren't people pushing for more access and for footpaths and areas of routing.
Is that because it's a wealthier island, that whole, this is mine, don't trespass?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's to do with wealth. It's entirely to do with ideas about ownership and property. And that the perception here is, as it is in England and Wales, that if it's mine, it is mine, and there are only certain circumstances where I'd let somebody else on it.
If you're a fan at all of Victorian engineering, this is just magical. I'm standing on top of the biggest water wheel I have ever seen in my life. This is a really picturesque wee village called Laxey, and you know, the key defining characteristic of Laxey is a lady called Isabella, and it's a huge water field. Just listen to this. I'm not entirely certain what is happening down there, but there's huge levers moving, massive bearings, everything is cast in iron.
It's thought to be the biggest working water wheel in the world, and it is. The sheer size of it is giving it an immense amount of power. The wheel's going round and round, which is driving a big beam, massive beam, backwards and forwards.
But we're not sure why.
Other than that, we're not sure why, but you're going to go and try and find out.
Absolutely. You know something else I found out? The guy that built this, a Mr. Dumbbell. Isn't that fabulous? I'll have to talk to the manager, Matthew Richardson.
This is the Great Laxey Wheel, or known on the Isle of Man as Lady Isabella, and she's so named after the wife of the Lieutenant Governor of that era when she was opened in 1854.
It's a beautiful, I mean, that's an overused phrase, I know, but it is a beautiful piece of Victorian engineering.
It is.
It's basically, it's white ashlar stone, and then you've got red and black railings, and everything's held together by huge chunks of cast iron. The bearings are utterly massive on this thing, and it must be balanced on a farthing.
It is. I mean, it's not a purely functional object. It's built with a great deal of aesthetic appeal in mind. You know, the people that built it, they could easily have constructed a machine to do this work much further up the valley, much more simple, much more functional item. Instead, they chose to construct something that was a visual statement in the landscape. Yeah. And if you've come up to the Laxey Wheel through the village of Laxey, down in the bottom of the valley, you will see this monument standing up on the hillside, the three legs of man emblazoned on the front of it. It is far more than a purely functional piece of equipment.
Yeah. Explain this to me, because I mean, you've got this wheel, which is, I mean, what diameter is it?
72 feet in diameter.
72 feet in diameter, right. Every so often it seems to stop,
yes.
And now it's started to move again,
yes.
But it's what, I would say it was running backwards.
Yes, exactly. Well, you've come on a day where you were experiencing one of the problems that the original mine company engineers would have experienced, because this wheel is fed from water that's gathered on all of the hillsides around this valley and channeled through an elaborate system of what's called lades to a cistern at the top of the valley, and then an underground pipe channels the water up through the tower to the top of the wheel using gravity.
Okay.
Now, when you get a very wet weather like we've had recently, these lades or channels on the hillsides can get blocked by debris, and that's what's happened this morning. So we're awaiting engineers to come out and clear the debris in one of the channels, which will restore the constant flow of water, so you'll get the wheel turning in a continuous fashion, which is what you want. So today, you're experiencing what could happen when they get a blockage like that. You get irregular water flowing onto the wheel, which causes it to stutter, stop occasionally, and then the force of gravity will send it back the other way.
And you get this big sort of douche of water down at the bottom.
Yeah,
first left, then right.
So, yeah, you're getting a little illustration of the inconsistency or the lack of reliability of water power. It was always a difficulty if they had a very dry summer here.
Yeah.
Didn't happen very often, I have to say, on the Isle of Man. But occasionally you get a dry summer, and when that happens, there's not enough water to power it. But that's a rare occurrence, I have to say.
Just to explain this again, you've got this massive wheel.
Yeah.
Then there's a crank.
Yes.
And there is a crankshaft that runs up what looks like a viaduct.
That's
I don't know how many arches there are there.
Yeah.
But basically, the crankshaft must be 150, nearly 200 metres long.
Yes. Yes.
And it's on wheels, so it's running backwards and forwards and rails.
Rod. It's a rod that's running along what we call the rod viaduct, with a travel of, say, 6 feet in either direction. At the end where the mine shaft is, you have an upside-down capital T that's connected to the rod that's travelling horizontally, and the two arms of the T raise pumps that are vertical in the shaft.
Got it.
And they are sucking up water from the lowest levels of the mine, discharging it onto a higher level. A second pump picks it up, takes it to the level above that. So gradually you're pumping out water from the lower levels.
Given the fact that, you know, charming though it is, water is not entirely predictable.
Yeah.
Why didn't they just stick in a steam engine?
Because coal doesn't occur naturally on the Isle of Man. There's no coal deposit on the Isle of Man.
Right.
So in the mid-19th century, when industry throughout Britain is going over to steam power and steam is driving the industry of Britain, the Isle of Man doesn't have the option. It's far too expensive to import coal on an industrial scale. They only imported coal here for domestic use. They did have a steam engine for those rare summers when it was very hot and they ran out of water. They needed a backup steam engine.
It was expensive.
But what they had a lot of was water.
Yeah.
So what you get here is a gradual increase in the size of the water wheel that's being employed. Starting from the 1790s, early 1800s, they start with small water wheels. By the 1850s, those water wheels have got bigger and bigger and bigger. And water didn't just drive this wheel. Water drove all of the equipment down in the valley that was used for crushing the ore as well. They made extensive use of the power of water travelling downhill.
My contract with the BBC allows me one daft question a day, and this is it.
Okay.
Given how beautifully this is engineered, you know, and how it's obvious power and potential, has anybody ever suggested using this as a renewable energy source?
They have, actually, A few years ago, we had the chap that does a lot of renovation projects, Dick Strawbridge. I think he's got a series on television.
Yeah.
He came over and he did a few calculations about how much electric power you could get out of it. It's not actually that much. It's surprisingly a small amount, so it's not really viable. You couldn't power the whole of Laxey with it, we'll put it that
Seriously.
Way.
Seriously? No, Laxey's not that big?
Not that big, no.
Yeah. I have to say, there's worse places to work. I mean, you're sitting in this wee glen, beautiful engineering.
Yeah. You're seeing it now when the industry's all gone, the valley has returned to nature, it's peaceful, it's quiet, there's birds singing. It wouldn't have been like this in the mining heyday. There would have been clatter, there would have been banging, there would have been machinery,
Smoke. And
there would have been pollution, large amounts of pollution. Because if you imagine the pumps are sucking that water out from the depths of the mine, they're heavily contaminated with antimony, lead, heavy metals, all that water
Bad
was disgorged straight into the Laxey River. So it killed the Laxey River. Laxey gets its name from the salmon, which was the traditional fish that was found in the river. They all died as a result of the pollution. It was only in the 60s that the salmon started to return.
Salmon aside, what was life like for the miners?
Very, very hard. I mean, in the 19th century, there were no health and safety laws or restrictions or regulations like we've got in industry today. It was more or less make it up as you go along.
Yeah.
So these miners were reaching the lowest levels by climbing ladders, vertical ladders, hand over hand. So they were slippery, they were muddy. They were using gunpowder, of course, because this is a metal mine. So they were blasting the rock out to get at the metal ore. And what they do is they set a charge, and the miners worked in gangs of, say, six, and it was not common to find lads of 12 or 15 working in a gang, and it was usually the lad that planted the gunpowder charge because he was the most agile and nimble and could get out of the way quick enough once they'd lit the fuse. And there were numbers of accidents underground. The worst mining accident that we had here was actually at the Snaefell mine, which is slightly further up the valley, when a candle was left burning over a weekend underground and started an underground fire, and that caused a build-up of carbon monoxide. And when the morning shift went down on the Monday morning, 19 miners died, overcome by carbon monoxide before they even realised what was happening to them. So a major expedition had to be launched to get just to get the bodies out. So that was the worst mining disaster that we had. But, you know, even when they weren't at work, the miners lived in small cottages. They had big families, you know, nine children, not uncommon. So you've got a whole family that's dependent on the wages that are coming out of this mine, which were never great. I mean, they were never really prosperous, but it kept employment in the valley.
Hello, my name is Kevin Holmes. I'm the head brewer of Oakles Brewery, and we're based in Douglas on the Alaman.
How long has the brewery been here?
The brewery's been on this site since 1994, but Dr. Oakle originally started the Oakles Brewery in 1850. But when he started up the brewery, he's a kind of the original hipster, really, an entrepreneur. He was brewing with steam and real innovator, and people were coming from all over Europe to kind of witness him and look at the brewery and read his books and his methods to kind of...
Explain the steam bit to me. I've never understood that.
It's kind of the optimum way to make beer with steam. It's part of the purification process, part of the boiling process, the making of the beer. It's the thing to use in breweries still to this day. But at the time, it was like cutting edge. It made beer a pure drink and what people wanted to drink at the time. We are the biggest beer producer on the island by far. We're not just island-based in terms of our sales. We've just won an International Brewing Award, which is kind of classed as the Oscars of the brew world. Everyone won that for the Manx Pale Ale.
The room we're in at the moment is what?
This is the brew house. This is initially where the beer's made, if you like, with our fermenting vessels. We make beer in a traditional way to the Manx purity laws, which are basically you can only use four things to make the beer. So you can use hops, malted barley, water and yeast. We can't substitute them ingredients with anything. The purity law was pushed by Dr. Oakle, and he was brought in 1874, and we still brew to the parameters of that today, which is great, kind of a selling point for us because we can market our products as pure.
I actually wrote this down because I was so impressed by the purity laws. This is extraordinary. The Manx Purity Law, 1874. No brewer shall use in the brewing, making, mixing with, recovering or colouring any beer or any liquid made to resemble beer or have in his possession any copperas, cocculus indicus, nox vomica, grains of paradise, guinea, pepper or opium, interesting, or any article, ingredient or preparation, whatever for, or as a substitute for malt, sugar or hops. Here endeth the first lesson.
This great pronunciation as well, by the way.
It's interesting because in medieval Scotland, it was a necessity for every small town and village to have its own brewery because there was no water treatment plants. It was actually safer to drink beer in the morning. Children drank beer in the mornings rather than drink the water. The water was dangerous.
Yes, even soldiers at the time of the Raj, that's where you get the name IPA, Indian Pale Ale, were sent away beer because it was better to drink than the water.
I've always wondered why it was called Indian Pale Ale. But that list of, saying a horrific list of ingredients, were people putting that kind of stuff in their
opium?
Yeah,
you've got opium as the substitute for the alcohol, so that you could get like a giddy feeling, let's say. And you've got grains of paradise on the list.
What are grains of paradise?
Kind of thing you want.
I don't know what it is, but I must have some.
They're like a stone of a fruit, kind of a pepper looking thing, and they give you a ginger type flavour. So they were used for a flavouring rather than using what you'd use like your hops and your traditional malted barley as your flavouring.
What kind of range of beers do you do nowadays?
We have three cores, which is the Manx Pale Ale, the MPA.
Tell you what, you've got a bar somewhere here, haven't you?
Yeah, we've got a bar
on
site.
Can we have a wee look?
Of course you can, yeah. No problem, right. Follow me.
Why didn't I think of that?
Like a practice.
Yeah, does it like a practice, yeah. I like this place.
Paul Laboratory here, is it?
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Test tubes and microscopes.
And retorts and all sorts of things and rubber tubing.
Yeah, we've got a fully functioning laboratory.
So what do you do here?
And we test the beer throughout the process to kind of again maintain the quality purity. And the purity.
I like this.
Yeah, this is the hood of the bar. It's the original copper from the original site before we moved up to this site. A copper is basically just a kettle. It's for boiling up of the wort, the beer.
So we asked you what kind of beers you had. You got four up on draft there.
Our staples are the Oakles MPA, the Manx Pale Ale. That's the one we've just won the International Brewing Award for. The Oakles IPA, the Indian Pale Ale, and the Oakles Bitter. There are our three standards, and we always have rotational, seasonal, or special on. We've just got Oakle's 1907 on, which is to commemorate the Manx TT. 1907 was the year of the first TT, so that ties in with that.
For people who don't drink beer, what's the difference between the MPA, the IPA and the bitter?
Well, the bitter is very traditional, so it's kind of like a darker mahogany colour. It's traditionally hopped with majority English hops. The IPA, it's an Indian pale ale, so it's quite hoppy. Traditionally, it's a standard journey to India. A pale beer, as it says in the name. And the MPA, the Manx Pale Ale, it's very tropically hopped, so it's hopped with things like Mosaic and Citra, kind of to give it kind of a citrusy, grapefruity, kind of lychee kind of flavour to it. It's really, really refreshing, really lovely beer.
Well, that sounds like a breakfast beer to me.
It sounds like a breakfast beer, but before we get to the actual tasting...
Oh, come on!
There's hundreds, if not thousands, of casks outside.
Yeah.
You're obviously producing a lot. I've only seen two people here.
Our standard staff is four full-time. During the busy periods, like TT, we have a guy come in and he works part-time for us.
So do you have the stockpile it for the TT races? Because I imagine these guys could drink you out.
Yeah, we start brewing for TT April time, because obviously there's no preservatives as such, artificial preservatives put into the beer. It's not pasteurised, so we can't brew it well in advance. We start brewing and prepping at the beginning of April. This TT has been a successful TT, so we're happy enough.
Have you got a bottle of it?
Yeah. Well, this is the MPA. It's a limited range. It's pretty straw in colour. If you take in the aromas, you should get tropical.
Yeah, you have a try.
No, I'll let you go first.
All right. Yeah. That's very refreshing, actually. I can pick up the grapefruit.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
Yeah. Anyway, if you could just leave us here, we'll be
fine. Yeah, lock up after yourself.
Quite, yeah. See, being a brewer, is it, again, this is sticking my head right in the noose, is it a science, is it a craft, is it an art? Because you talk about it and you kind of get sort of slightly misty-eyed about it.
I think it's a combination of all of those things. You're kind of doing a science experiment, which is great. You've got to control your parameters and repeatabilities to key and cleanliness of the plant. But it's also the craft element. You want something to taste in a certain way. You want something to smell a certain way. And so you do get the craft, but it's trying to find the right balance in between.
Do you ever do something and just, it's a happy accident? Something that you hadn't expected suddenly jumps out of the glass at you?
We have a small kit that we do experimental brews on. I was drinking IPA one time and eating ginger biscuits, and so... together,
it's the breakfast of champions.
Yeah, we got something from that, so we've done a few experimentals with ginger and an IPA based beer, which we're looking at things like that.
I'll give you a top marketing tip. Ginger, fantastic cure for seasickness. Bottles of beer on the boat.
Guaranteed seasickness cure.
You know, when you said we're looking to expand, you can get yourself a job. You just.
I don't know about you, but I can hear a whistle.
Ridiculously excited. We saw the steam train passing through the countryside and it just looked fabulous. It's a proper choo-choo train.
It's the sound of a train in the distance.
Exactly. Romance, travel, adventure. Yes, we're heading for Douglas, but the principle's the same.
We do have another plane overhead. Everything seems to be in the main flight path.
Yeah. But this is lovely, though, because there's a wee station here and this is at Castleton. And there's big mature trees either side of the track, and it's creating a natural tunnel. So the train should appear out of the sunlight.
It's a beautiful, I'm guessing, Victorian station.
Yeah.
But no train yet.
Patience.
What time's the train due?
2 minutes.
All right, thank you.
So I'm going to run across. What did you say?
If you could hear that klaxon in the background in the very distance, well, that's Mill Road Barrier, a little bit round the corner.
So I've got about a minute to go, haven't we?
Yeah.
Here we go. Number 13. There is such a childish surge of delight. Oh, it's a mass of gleaming brass and copper, oozing steam, that wonderful smell, and these wonderful wooden carriages, the Isle of Man Railway Company, bright red with a slash of yellow, single compartments.
Oh, I haven't been in a carriage like this in 40 years. Not in 40 years.
Because we've got the carriage to itself.
Yes.
It's a compartment one. Indeed. This lovely leather strap. You squeak that in.
That's it. That's what holds. You see, you have to put the toggle on to get the window right. So that closes up. See, and put the. That's it.
Right. It's about time we left, isn't it? Oh, there's a man with a green flag. He'd be the guard, will he?
I wonder if they're looking for a fat controller. If so, which of us will get the job?
Here we are. He's closing the final doors. Somebody just got in at the last minute there. Guards marching for the back of the train. Hello. We're locked in.
There's an Irish guy in the next carriage. We could talk to him.
Well,
right. We're doing a programme for the BBC. Where are you from?
Dublin.
Dublin, right. Yeah. You've been on this one before?
No, this is the first time on it, so it's great.
You've got a big grin on your face, just like us.
The excitement of it, isn't it? It's great. It's not every day you do it.
No, that's for sure. Anyway, I'll leave you to it.
No bother, take care.
I can hear another train in the distance. Is it two trains? Yeah.
The guard's coming.
Oh, he's going to be coming to get tickets.
We're just waiting for the Port Erin bound train. It's not far away now. It's only a single line. We can't physically advance any further forward until the other train's adjacent to us. Okay.
So how long is it going to take us to get to Douglas?
We'll be there 5 past. All right.
What's your job?
Mind the guard. You're all in my tender care now. I'm responsible for the safe running of the train. Although the chaps at the front provide the motive power, the train is in the guard's authority.
So you're the important one?
Well, I'm part of the team, shall we say.
Can he go unless you wave your green flag?
No, not at all. I can't go here until the station master says I can. The other stations down the line, where it's not manned, I have the authority to start the train, whereas here, I'm under the authority of the station master while I'm in the station limits.
Is this just a job, or do you really enjoy it?
I really enjoy it. For me, it's not only a running the trains, but it's meeting with all the passengers. Locals, it's mostly first name terms. It's quite a regular scutch, to use a Manx term, of locals. And especially the last fortnight, TT fortnight, people from all around the world, and it's great for them to see the trains. I enjoy it particularly because I can get by in three languages, so I can entertain the troops, so to speak, in their own language to a degree anyway.
Was this Manx as well?
No, French, Dutch and German.
Train's pulled up right beside us. Where are you going to?
I'm going to Port Erin.
Just to describe what's happening here, we're on one train and we're leaning across to the other one. We've got our Irish friend next to us. So where are you from?
We're from Yorkshire, but we've sailed into Peel.
And you've given up your yacht to come in the steam train?
Yeah, definitely.
What's it like? We haven't left yet.
The train's fabulous. Yeah. Really enjoying it.
Brilliant. Have a good time.
Thank you.
Times where you don't have to say anything, you don't need contributors.
Nope. Fields of cows out there, little puffs of grey cloud going past, it's actually the smoke from the engine, and that fantastic.
If you look at my microphone, lumps of coal all over it. I've got to listen to this for a while. About this is the guard was saying.
The one thing.
Many, many levels. But he was saying that people use this as a commuter train to Douglas.
Yes.
You know, it's a working train, it's not just for tourists.
No. Well, I was asking the guard too. I can't remember what he said. At one stage there were 16 engines on this line. I think currently at the moment, I think he said about 6. And there's 2 in the shed that haven't moved in a long, long time. They need a lot of TLC. I can't remember being in a situation before where we were sitting in one steam train and another one pulled up beside it. And they're immaculate.
Yeah, they are absolutely gorgeous. We should have things like this in
in Scotland. I know we've got the Grantham one, you've got Bowness, but this is just dinky and beautiful and lovely. Yes. What a joy. We're there already? Just come past the level crossing and we're coming into, oh, I don't know how you pronounce that, Balasala? Oh, they've got a curry train car as well.
They've got a pie and mash train, that's the one for me.
Pie and mash train, the curry club train, the tapas train. They obviously do different meals on different days. Fantastic.
Yeah. That's excellent. One of the things that strikes you about the Elliman is it's the ingenuity. You know, it's not a huge area, but they're really making a lot of what they've got.
Balasala.
Okay.
Place of the willow tree. Bala means place, farm, homestead on the Elliman in Manx Gaelic. And sala, I think, is salicylic acid. From Latin salix, Balasala.
Okay.
And I think in Scotland, I think Socky Hall Street is your take on Sally's willow trees.
Could be.
And lo and behold, what have you got? The willow tree rooms. Charles Rennie Mackintosh.
That was kind of like a run-by interview. God, he's good. There's something fabulously soporific about hurtling through the countryside at a good, oh, I say, 20 miles an hour with these little puffball clouds of grey smoke going past.
It's just wonderful. You can almost imagine Enid Blyton sitting in the corner. It's a whole famous five adventure. It's two adults, grown-up men in shorts, getting bits of coal in their eye. It is fantastic, and it's a delightful island. It's brilliant.
Sadly, that's all we've got time for this edition. We're going to bring you more of the Isle of Man. We're going to carry on chuntering along here, but the sound of this is just so fantastic that we're going to let this play you out. From all of the team at BBC Aberdeen on the Isle of Man, thanks for listening.